Good afternoon. I am Brandon Becker of WilmerHale, a former associate director of the Division of Market Regulation and moderator for the Securities and Exchange Commission Historical Society's program today on Keeping the Markets Open, Lessons Learned from the 1987 Market Break. I'd like to set the table with a few preliminary remarks and then turn it over to Chairman Reuter. First, of course, I'd like to welcome those in attendance here in the SEC auditorium and all those listening to the live broadcast on www.sechistorical.org. The SEC Historical Society, which is independent of the Securities and Exchange Commission and receives no government funding, preserves and shares SEC and securities industry information through its virtual museum and archive, also located at www.sechistorical.org. The museum is free and accessible worldwide at all times. Today's program will be preserved in the virtual museum in audio, podcast, and transcript formats after the broadcast. And I commend to everyone the Historical Society's website. It's a wealth of information. Keeping the Markets Open is the first of many educational and celebratory activities that the SEC Before we begin, I would like to thank the Market Regulation Committee, Herb Brooks, Gordon Fuller, Alton Harvey, and Jim Young for working with me to plan this program. In addition, I'd like to extend special thanks to Carla Rossidi and the staff of the SEC Historical Society, as well as Christy O'Bear of WilmerHale. In that regard, Carla would think it amiss if I didn't tell you that if you want to leave any checks with her at the end of the program, this society would welcome your contribution. I would also like to acknowledge the contributions of John Phelan, former chairman and CEO of the New York Stock Exchange, and Alton for their remembrances of the 1987 market break to the Virtual Museum and Archive. Alton also has shared a copy of the SEC's report of the market break, and John has contributed video of the New York Stock Exchange press conferences held during the week of the break. All of these materials are permanently placed in the museum, and I encourage you to access them after the program. Indeed, I think that both Alton and John's remarks and papers are both instructive, entertaining, and very well written. Joining me today for the panel discussion are people who have valuable insights into not just what happened in 87, but what those events mean for us today and what are the fundamental truisms of the market break. To my far right is Andrea Corcoran, now with Promontory Financial Group, LLC, who was with the Commodity Futures Trading Commission in 1987. To her left is Rick Ketchum, now with the New York Stock Exchange Regulation, Inc., who was director of the SEC Division of Market Regulation during the break. And to his left is Chairman David Reuter. To my left is William Billy Johnston, who was at the New York Stock Exchange at that time. And to his left is Eric Seary, the current director of the SEC's Division of Market Regulation. Chairman Cox will join us at a later time. I'd like to start, before we begin, even the society, true to its alumni status, would note that our comments are not reflective of the Historical Society, of the SEC, of the members of the SEC, of anyone who hopes to work for the SEC, or anyone affiliated with the federal government. Let me start by setting a few of the highlights from the history and then turn it over to Chairman Reuter. On August 25th of 1987, the Dow hit a high of then 2722.42, up 43% year to date, a remarkable growth pattern between January and August. During the week of October 5th through 9th, it fell about 159 points and then had relatively quiet days on the 12th and 13th. However, on Wednesday, October 14th, a trade deficit was announced, $1.5 billion higher than expected. Foreign exchange markets began to sell dollars. Bond traders sold in London and U.S. bond markets. The 30-year bond traded above a 10% yield for the first time in 2 years, and the dollar began to weaken. If any of this sounds familiar, just ignore those analogies for the moment. In addition, the House Ways and Means Committee proposed legislation to end tax benefits in connection with financing of corporate takeovers, stimulating risk arbitrageurs to sell the stock of takeover candidates, and the S&P 500 futures contract fell sharply through the day. Eventually, the Dow ended up down 95 points, a then-record point loss of 3.81% on volume of 207 million shares. Thursday saw London and Tokyo markets follow the downward trends, and the U.S. market opened with heavy selling by portfolio insurers. The Dow itself had another down day, closing down 57 points, or 2.93%. In the later portion of the day, Chemical Bank announced that it was increasing its prime lending rate, and then Treasury Secretary James Baker stated that the U.S. could, quote, accommodate further adjustments in the value of the dollar. On October 16th, a freak hurricane closed the London markets, and the expiration of various options on several stock indices occurred. There was heavy selling throughout the day, and the Dow ultimately closed down 108 points, or 4.6%, to set a new record for a one-day close. For the week, the Dow was down 235 points, or 9.49%, representing a drop of 17.5% from the August 25th high. Over the weekend, mutual funds faced an overhang of additional redemption requests. Secretary Baker on Meet the Press continued to discuss whether or not the United States will sit back and watch surplus countries jack up their interest rates and squeeze growth worldwide on the expectation that the United States somehow will follow by raising its interest rates. There were also discussions of possible airstrikes and developments in the Middle East. And on that cheery note, Chairman Reuter came to work on Monday morning, October 19th.
I'm going to put this on now. Well, I came to work that morning knowing that the market had declined, and we had talked throughout the week at the commission about what to do. And I may say that much of what I say today it reflects the great wisdom of both Rick and Brandon, who were at the Division of Market Regulation then. On October 19, the market knew that the Nikkei index had declined by 2.35%. It knew that the London FTSE index was declining, and indeed it declined by 10.84% by the time it closed during the morning. And at the start of the day, we began to see strong selling pressure. In technical terms, there were imbalances on the sell side. There was tremendous institutional pressure to sell. And by 10 o'clock in the morning, there were 95 Standard & Poor's stocks not open. And at 10:30, 11 of the 30 Dow Jones stocks were not open. That morning, I was giving a speech at a hotel here on behalf of the American Stock Exchange, and I found that people weren't paying much attention to me. I thought it was because my speech was bad, but when I finished the speech at about 11 o'clock, I found that the market had been declining, and I think it had been declined by about 200 points at that point. I went back to the office to try to find out what was happening, they gave me the astounding news that the market was declining. It was a very bewildering time because I had come in with some experience about the markets because of some work I'd done with Milton Cohen in Chicago. And I kept asking what we could do. And I think the answer was not much. During the day, there wasn't much to do to stem a decline. At one point, I discovered I'd only been at the commission for about 2.5 months, and I discovered that there was no terminal on the sixth floor of the commission where my office was, which showed the stock quotes. So I went down to the fifth floor where the Division of Market Regulation had one Was it one terminal?
I think we had two.
Had two. So
which
I
we gladly shared with you.
And so I went down there to look at what was called the bridge data system, and I discovered, which I hadn't looked at, I discovered that there was a very simple code, that if stocks were down, the stock was in red, and if stocks were up, the stocks were in green. But by the time I got down there, everything was red, and I stood in quite a crowd looking at this, and again asking what we could do, and the answer was not much. By the end of the day, the Dow had declined 508 points to 1738.7, which was a decline of 22.61%. We asked ourselves later on what had happened, and of course, a great many things had. Do you want me to talk a little bit about that?
Sure.
The selling pressure came from institutional investors. Some of it came from index arbitrage between the futures exchange and the stock exchange. By that time, the derivative index products at the futures exchange were creating what we called a bulletin board on the bridge system, which showed what the futures markets were anticipating in terms of declines and the difference in the futures predictions and the stock markets were, I think, close to 100 points during most of that day. We found out that institutions were selling using programs, and at least one large institution sold a million shares that day. Maybe the numbers aren't quite right, Rick, but there was a million shares, but they sold them, and these were large numbers then. They sold them in 100,000 units, and the people on the exchange floor kept saying it was like a wave. It was like a bombshell. Every hour, these large sales would come in. So there was institutional pressure. So-called portfolio insurance was used. That was a system by which people attempted to, instead of selling short, they had a system that they thought they could sell in during the market, during the daytime, to get out of the markets. And the problem was that a great many people had these portfolio systems and they didn't work very well. They couldn't get their trades off. The systems, we later found out, hadn't worked well. There was queuing and clogging in the order routing systems. The New York Stock Exchange was having trouble executing its trades. The printers weren't working very well. At the NASDAQ market, some of the market makers simply closed up shop for the day. There simply was an absence of buying support. The specialists at the New York Stock Exchange had virtually exhausted their capital and weren't able to step up. So by the end of the day, we really had experienced this tremendous decline, and we didn't know what was going to happen the next day. Rick, would you just for a minute tell them what you did about calling the brokerage firms? I thought that was a very interesting event that occurred during that day.
Sure, David. I maybe stepping back, and none of this is going to sound surprising to either Eric or Chairman Cox in dealing with the liquidity challenges of the last few months. In order to put October 19th in context, and I think both you and Brandon really did, you have to step back and understand, in the ways that David described, how the markets worked versus how the markets work today. The equity markets were fundamentally manual. The vast majority of orders executed in the New York Stock Exchange, albeit there were electronic systems, were executed manually with respect to verbal interaction with the floor brokers. And even with respect to the large number of electronic orders that have become steadily more important as a result of interaction with the futures markets, with index arbitrage orders and program orders, those orders printed out behind the booth to be torn off, and Billy Johnston can can talk some more about the impact of that and the almost inevitable queuing that occurs. The NASDAQ market was fundamentally a phone market. To the extent that it had electronic executions, it was for small orders, and the firms didn't have the type of electronic capabilities to protect themselves from taking large and exposed positions as the amount of volume coming through that electronic execution system spiked. And all of that led them to become less and less accessible. So you had an environment first, which is probably critical to the anatomy of most crashes, along with exuberance up front, and that is a fear resulting from inaccessibility. And as we headed into the night, because as David accurately says, regulators can't do a hell of a lot about what markets do as they go on. In fact, it would be a really bad idea for them to try. Our primary focus, not very different, I'm quite confident from knowing from the CFTC and what Andrea was doing that night as well, was to understand where the exposures were. And it is something that we had done as a drill in a variety of situations with much, much smaller movements, although remembering that 3.81% and 4.6% is more of a percent movement than we presently have seen in the markets for years. The effort that day was basically to canvas and understand where the weak exposures were coming from the marketplace. And where they were a variety of pieces that weren't terribly surprising. One with respect to the largest clearing firm on the options side at that present time, First Options, an area where basically handling a large percentage of the options market maker activity that was particularly exposed given the accessibility issues and the huge volatility in that day. They were with respect to specialist capital. Again, Billy can talk a good deal more about this afterwards. Specialist firms were highly profitable at that point, but there were a large number on the New York Stock Exchange, and they were effectively partnerships. And while having significant amount of capital, they were not designed to be the sole entity standing in front of a virtually indescribable rush of orders. And then there were a variety of things that causes from these type of situations as you create panic from a lack of transparency. Concerns of credit with respect to major players, difficulties in initial delays with respect to handling marks from the Chicago Merck Clearing Corporation that gave the impression of a potential exposure and possible serious problems in the Merck that in fact didn't happen, that spread to the other side with respect to major firms who had the impression for a period of time that they were going to be absolutely out of liquidity from the absence of large payments, to things going on in foreign markets, many of which had basically ceased to function by Tuesday morning. So our focus really on that night with other regulators, I think in reasonably effective coordination, was really trying to find out where those risks were, working with the New York Fed, working with the CFTC, and also to look for potential areas where we might encourage liquidity and might eliminate unnecessary restrictions on liquidity, and we can come back to talking about that with issuer repurchases.
David, could I interrupt your flow just to give Andrea and Billy a chance to talk about the 19th and the night of the 19th?
Good.
Okay. Andrea, you want to start? Sorry to catch you off, but if you could just sort of give a sense of what you folks were taking a look at.
I'm out of order for what I thought I was going to do, but there
my
you
apologies.
Go. I mean, the CFTC, interestingly, I would say, typically has a surveillance meeting every Friday. And every Friday, exposed markets are reviewed by the Commission using our large trader reports, which show the largest counterparties in the markets, especially those who are on the wrong way of a market move. And we had a surveillance meeting on the Friday before the crash, which was, I guess, Friday the 13th. And it's my recollection that we had, for some reason, invited at least people from the Treasury to that meeting, possibly because of the discussions about interest rates that were going on in Europe and in the United States. over the weekend, because we, being a very global market, were watching, as was everyone else also, the developments in the overseas community, and there was the news was so bad that Kalo Heinemann decided that we should have another surveillance meeting the morning of the 19th.
He was then the acting chairman of the
CFTC, and we did, and we were in communication with the SEC during the day, and I would say that we more or less heaved a sigh of relief at the end of the day. I think, as I said to some people, there was some intensity in the discussions that occurred on the 19th, but I think everyone had to find out where their system was within the building that had all the timely information on what was going on in the market. Ours was with the economists. But, you know, as of the close of the 19th, I think we felt relatively confident that we'd weathered rather difficult storms so far. So good.
Mm-hmm. Billy, I'm sorry to grab you out of sequence, but if you don't mind.
Stepping back to what Brandon's introduction started with, the market's down about 20% from the August 25th high. It's down 9%, 8.5%, 9% the week prior to October 19th. And Brandon makes the wonderful comment about London being closed. I was in London for the first release ever of Glaxo's earnings in dollar terms, and in fact enjoyed that storm Thursday night, the 15th, in London, as windows were popping out of apartment buildings and trying to get out of London on Friday. I get back to find out that our inventories are about two times as large as they normally were. And Chairman Reuter and Rick both mentioned inventories. That is a classic part of the problem, of the perfect storm, if you will, that you already have dealers both upstairs and down that are lugging more inventory than they normally lug. So coming into Monday morning, and we go to the construct of the floor of the exchange. In those days, there were about 50 small firms, the largest of which was Spear Leeds and Kellogg, who was the market maker perhaps in 150, 200 stocks at the time. Most of us were four, five, six partner firms making markets in 35, 40, 45 stocks. So we did not have, A, the significant capital that firms have today, and B, we did not have the wherewithal to go find capital because we were partnerships, as Rick commented on. So here we are. To say frightened would be a mild exaggeration. Knowing that the market is going down, seeing the absence of buyers, noting that any bids that we had from the prior day, Friday, or the week before have suddenly disappeared, and there are nothing but sellers. The day, the 19th, went as smoothly as it could. Rick mentioned technology. We were at that time in the second iteration of a display book. We were one of two firms that had all of our stocks on the display book. So for us, it was mildly better, if I can use that term, than it might have been for other firms. And in fact, after the close, several people asked why it seemed to be a little easier. And that will lead into a discussion as we talk about things that we've learned from the 19th and 20th as to how the technology has proceeded and the good things that came from technology in terms of the floor of the exchange.
I'm going to re-seize the microphone. Thank you. On the evening of the 19th, as I was asking Rick, what should I do? And Rick said, go home. And I hung around for a little bit, but the telephone rang. The telephone precedent in Washington is that you can find people usually around 6 or 6:30 in their offices where you can't find them. So Senator Riegel, the chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, called me at about 6:30, and he said, Chairman Reuter, he said, I want you to call the President of the United States and tell him to make a statement calming the markets. I had met the President when I was sworn in, and I hadn't heard from him since. And I thought I had been sworn in on August 7th. I thought it would be presumptuous of me to call the President and tell him what to do. So I called the White House and talked to the person I knew best there, and I said as cautiously as I could, I've had a call from Senator Riegel of the Senate Banking Committee, and he suggests that I call the White House to ask the President to make a calming statement about the markets. I thought that way I wasn't demanding that the President make the statement. And lo and behold, he did make a statement the next day. So it was a little, to me, a little blip on the way Washington works to have that call from me and then from me to the White House. That led us to October 20th, and in the morning we were all pretty happy because the Dow rose 196 points, and we thought, well, we're getting a rebound. And then at about 10 o'clock it began to decline, and by 12:31 it had declined to 1707, which was below the Monday's close. We had a call at the Securities and Exchange Commission from John Phelan, the chairman of the New York Stock Exchange, saying, we think we're going to close the markets. There's some dispute about whether he said we are going to close the markets or we think we're going to close the markets. He then said, but I'm going to call the White House and tell them our plans. So he said, will you support us? And I, again, asked Rick. And I said, Rick, the New York plans to close. Should we support them? And Rick's answer, which I thought was sound, was, the markets know what's going on. We're in Washington, they're in New York, and we have to accept their judgment. So I said to John Phelan, yes, we'll support you. As soon as he hung up, we called, Rick and his staff called the CFTC and said, New York is planning to close. And we called all of the exchanges that were under our jurisdiction and told them that. The Chicago Merck derivative stock index closed at 12:13 and did not reopen until 1:05. The CBOT major market index did not close at all and rallied at 12:30. But I may say that from my point of view, then by 1:12 the Dow had rallied to 1843 and it was about 100 points above its Monday close. It declined, but we didn't have a final closing that was dramatically bad. It was 102 points up from its Monday close. But during
the New York Stock Exchange did not close.
No, the New York Stock Exchange did not close. But I may say that from my point of view, that time from about 12 to 1, on the 20th was by far the scariest point in that entire market crash experience, and that was that we might have had the New York Stock Exchange closing on a random basis, not in a pre-closing as we now have with circuit breakers, but on a random basis because there was no buying support on the floor. And for me, that experience really reinforces the need for planning among our markets at the SEC, with the Fed and the Treasury, about what might happen if we had a dramatic down day in the volume we had in 1987. We have not had a panic decline of that kind since. We've had some declines, but it seems to me that we are in need of looking at our systems and our financial support for the markets in ways that would prevent the kind of possible close that we almost had on that day. I know that in John Phelan's paper prepared for this event, he says New York will never close. But we came close, and that's where my fears are in this point. Rick, I'll now turn it over to you for your comments, if you want.
Well, again, I certainly agree with David that the most terrifying day was Tuesday and not Monday. To place yourself in it, as many of you sitting in the crowd as ex-regulators or existing regulators and the rest, and it again is important to understand that day, from a variety of different perspectives, whether you're operating in the industry, an investor, or a regulator, basically most of your conceptions of the infrastructure of markets, how they worked and how they were likely to work, had been stripped away. If you looked at the things regulators could do, I'm sure we'll get back to it, but obviously the Fed did a great deal from the standpoint of both pronouncements and actual actions to encourage liquidity. The SEC worked with the New York Stock Exchange to get out clarifying indications that made it a little easier for issuers to be comfortable about engaging in repurchases outside of the safe harbor, something the SEC now does consistently when there's troubling days. But you did have a situation that day where people had lost their bearings as to where the market could end up, how much it could go down, whether another 20% break was perfectly possible. You had a situation where, again, as you see in many situations like this summer, where credit quality was unclear, where rumors were rampant, where some things were clear, that many market participants down on the floor of exchanges were out of capital, where from the standpoint of specialists, and again, looking at a different marketplace, the New York Stock Exchange at that point was extremely dependent on the specialist as the buyer of last resort, not to go over a cliff, but to steadily address and deal with volatility concerns and the rest. And yet a large number of those specialists not only were out of capital, but as Billy indicated, did not have the effective lines of credit, and even the major firms did not have the effective locked-in lines of credit and flexibility and diversity of business that existed today. And so you were in an environment at that time. The buying came in at 12 o'clock. Who knows why? Lots of suggestions in a variety of different ways why it came at that point or not other points. But while undoubtedly we will end this panel with a strong confidence that it's a terrible idea ever to shut down markets or a variety of other things, and it is, you do have to understand in looking at these situations that regulators are dealing on an ad hoc basis with practical situations. And on October 20th, there was a lack of confidence to buy stock across the board. And there was a very real risk if buyers hadn't come in at 12:30 that the markets would not have been able to operate for the rest of the day.
Chairman Cox, we've been talking inside the agency and the markets. You had a different perspective. And what were your observations on the 19th and 20th?
Well, I was at La Casablanca at the other end of the telephone call that David is talking about. 20 years ago is a long time ago in some senses, but at least in my case, in the case of my involvement, the final chapter, at least the epilogue, wasn't written until earlier this year when a writer of financial fiction named Paul Erdman died in the wine country in California to little public notice. Years ago, he'd started his first book from a Swiss jail cell where he was locked up on charges of illegal speculation in the futures market, and he started writing his first book there. As a novelist, he became eventually one of the world's great doomsday forecasters, and in one of those quirks of history that turn out to be consequential, he wrote a bestseller called The Crash of 79, which became vacation reading for the recently retired Senate Majority Leader Howard Baker. Just over 2 years into his retirement, Howard Baker got a call from President Reagan asking him to replace Don Regan as the chief of staff. And as you know, he said yes, and as part of the package he brought with him to the White House, A.B. Culverhouse, his trusted lawyer, who became the new counsel to the president and my new boss. Shortly after Senator Baker came on board, he met with me to talk about what I was working on and some of the issues that he'd like me to address, and he told me in particular that he'd recently read a novel about how the president used his emergency powers in an effort to save the world from global financial collapse, and did the president in fact have these powers, and was there a shelf-ready White House contingency plan to deal with worldwide market crisis? Well, that, of course, turned into a project, And I was asked to write a detailed memo describing what were the emergency powers that the president might exercise in a market crisis. That was in February of 1987. So fast forward to October of that year when the stock market began what would become the largest one-day percentage drop in history. And the problems, of course, didn't end on Monday. Tuesday, the 20th, was also a big deal. The following day, the market dropped again, and there was even more and a different kind of panic. An emergency meeting was called in the chief of staff's office. And, of course, they said, get Cox up here. He wrote that memo. And so I was summoned urgently. The meeting was notable, as all of these emergency meetings are, not only for its emergency and its gravity, but also for who wasn't there. This is, of course, at a time when physical presence mattered even more because everyone wasn't carrying around sophisticated telecommunications computer stuff in their pockets. So you had to be there. Among the people who were there were financial heavyweights such as Marlon Fitzwater, the press secretary. He ought to have been there because actually one of the topics of this meeting was, as David said, you know, what is the president going to say? But among the people who weren't there was Beryl Sprinkle, the president's chief economist. And so I found myself sitting there with just a half a dozen others talking about some very important matters. And in the midst of this White House strategy session in the chief of staff's office, the phone rang. Senator Baker got up from the table and answered it, and he said so little that you couldn't tell, at least from the White House end of the phone conversation, to whom he'd been talking or what they had discussed. And he came back to the table and told us that he'd just spoken with John Phelan and that John was making a courtesy call to let him know that he was going to close the New York Stock Exchange. And that sort of hung over the table like a clammy fog, but nobody said anything. Now, at this point, I'd practiced law for 10 years. I'd been a securities law partner in a major firm, and I was accustomed to giving advice, but this seemed as if it should be somebody else's portfolio. But nobody said anything. So finally, even though I was the lawyer in the group, not the economist, I said to Senator Baker, you're not going to let them do that, are you? And he asked what I thought would happen in consequence of closing the market, and I ticked off the most important reasons not to do it that I could think of, that closing the market would be seen as a threat to the liquidity of equities, that it would cause even more panic selling in other markets, that it would eliminate the opportunity for the market to self-correct or for people to come in and buy what they consider to be bargains on the cheap, and that it would raise dicey and novel questions, such as at what price to reopen trading in particular securities that the New York Stock Exchange had never had to face before. So he asked me on what authority he could insist that the market stay open, and I said, just call him and tell him the President of the United States wants to keep the market open. So we went back to the phone, and he did that. We now also know that the White House wasn't the only source dispensing that advice, and we know that the market stayed open. There's a further ironic connection between Senator Baker's coming aboard in the White House in 1987 and what we're talking about here today. A.B. Culverhouse, the lawyer that Senator Baker brought over with him, was a securities lawyer like me. Today he's the managing partner of O'Melveny & Myers. Shortly after the two of them came aboard, there was a vacancy in the chairmanship of the Securities and Exchange Commission. So Senator Baker naturally looked to AB for advice, and in turn AB assigned the project to me because I had the finance portfolio in the counsel's office. So I offered up a suggestion of a securities law scholar who I was very much impressed with and had first become impressed with as a law review editor when I was writing about 10b-5, and that was, of course, Professor David Reuter, whom in the event President Reagan really did select, and not only did he become chairman, but he was then in the captain's chair during these market events in 1987, and the nation couldn't have had a finer leader at that time. Just as was the case for many of today's panelists, October 19th was for me just the beginning of my work. President Reagan decided to create a task force to take a look at how all of this came about, to investigate the causes and to make recommendations. He decided upon Nick Brady as chairman and selected an executive director that I'd known very well before, because he was my department chairman when I was on the faculty at Harvard Business School. That was Bob Glauber. And Bob picked as his deputy director Dave Mullins, another finance colleague of mine from there. So when I brought the task force members along with Bob and David in to meet the president, I started on a new project serving as lawyer for the Brady Commission, beginning with writing Executive Order 12614, which established the Task Force on Market Mechanisms. That presidential task force started its work on November 5th. They spent 2 months exhuming all of what happened and writing the autopsy. Their recommendations led to, among other things, the now familiar circuit breakers. They also included some valuable advice that I took with me to Congress. They highlighted, of course, index arbitrage and other structural flaws and anomalies as the real culprit, but also in the same way that the Great Chicago Fire is blamed on Mrs. O'Leary's cow, they traced the events of Black Monday to earlier selling pressure in the period between October 14th and October 16th, when the Dow fell by over 250 points, significant at the time. And that selling, they said, was triggered primarily by two proximate causes: disappointingly poor merchandise trade figures, and the filing of anti-takeover tax legislation, which led to risk arbitrageurs selling stocks of takeover candidates, and in turn a precipitate decline and a general ripple effect throughout the market. So whenever my colleagues in Congress subsequently told me, as Dan Rostenkowski once did, that the markets don't pay attention to the bills that we file, I remind them of this story.
David?
I just wanted to take a footnote on this, that one of the agencies that did do really well during the crash was the Federal Reserve Board. When Alan Greenspan came back to Chicago, he'd been in Texas and reversed his trip after he found out how bad the market had come down. He, in the next morning, made an announcement which effectively said that the Federal Reserve Board would make credit available to the money center banks. And then, as we understand it, Jerry Corrigan, who was the president of the New York Fed, called the money center banks and said, now the Federal Reserve Board is making money available to you to borrow or to obtain, and we want you to be able, and we want you to lend money to the brokerage firms who are going to be calling you for credit. And I think those two events were extremely important in repairing the market and providing liquidity for it. And if you look back as to what happened this summer, you see something of that similar nature going on in an effort to provide credit in uneasy markets.
There's a nice description of that, as well as President Corrigan's calls in Chairman Greenspan's recent book, The Age of Turbulence. Andrea, you want to talk about the CFTC? I took you out of order. Would you like to come back?
Well, I just say there were two or three points about the 20th. I mean, the first was that, yes, indeed, the futures markets closed. Some people felt they should have closed on the 19th. Typically, futures markets products have price limits at some level that automatically shut down and tamp down volatility, and they don't totally close the market, because if the price moves off the price limit, it automatically reopens, so it's not, doesn't raise some of the issues on the security side. And I think because of the experience of the 19th, where the futures led the cash for so long because there were such imbalances on the cash side and so much of the market was really closed, that you didn't really have, we felt we didn't even have reliable prices on which the futures markets could operate. So when they heard that it was likely that the stock market would close, they prophylactically closed the market, because what they didn't want was all of that spillover coming immediately to the futures if the stock market shut down. And I mean, that's one of the reasons that the circuit breaker idea was such an important idea, because it did say that there would be a point at which all the markets would close together. They wouldn't come apart because they weren't functioning properly, which was really what happened on the 19th. And you wouldn't have to close them and inject a whole lot of hysteria into the marketplace by the mere fact of taking that emergency action. A second thing that happened on the 20th was that was the day really that highlighted the issues with, I would call the plumbing or the clearing systems, maybe not so much as to how they actually work, but as to how they were really understood to work. And because people had to settle in cash their futures losses, and because it's a zero-sum system and the losses will equal the gains, once people respond to their closing their clearing instructions or their settlement instructions, the market should ultimately clear once the money is moved over the wires. But there was a lot of problems with money moving, and there was a delay, and there was uncertainty in the market, and there was really fear that the market wouldn't settle, and that became one of the major focuses of the president's working group on the crash, looking very closely at issues with the clearing and settlement system and seeing how those could be fixed. And I guess the final more sort of interesting thing to me was that the Wall Street Journal, you may know, won a Pulitzer Prize for an article it wrote about the activities that occurred on the Chicago Board of Trade on October 20th, claiming that the floor traders who were trading a clone of the Dow Jones industrial average, because Dow Jones would not permit them to trade or buy the Dow Jones industrial average or license it, that was known as the MMI, and that index went from a discount of 60 points to a premium of 12 points within 5 or 6 minutes, pushing the market up. And they claimed that these futures traders were the savior of the market. Well, in researching this on the internet, because, you know, that's where we all do our, in Googling this crisis to see what had been said about, I was quite interested to see that a much later pundit cited this as a conspiracy that represented the covert activities of the PPT, or Plunge Protection Team, an alleged shadow private sector savior group linked to the government, which has intervened in multiple emergencies to support the marketplace.
Welcome to the New York Post.
On that note, let me just turn to Billy one more time to see whether you'd like to add thoughts on the 20th before we go into conspiracy land.
Well, let's start back with the night of the 19th, as Chairman Reuter alluded to. The savior for all of us, I think, was the fact that the Fed did come in and free up capital. When we got back to our offices Monday night, we were all figuring out how we could pay for this 5, 6, 7 times normal inventory that we'd accumulated the day of the 19th. So, Chairman Reuter, with your good work at the SEC and with the great work of the Fed, that eased some of the tension. But Rick made the comment, Tuesday was by far the worst of the 2 days. The free fall in the market from 10:30 to noon after we got that 100-plus point rally was the most frightening part of the 2 days, because as we made new lows, and Chairman Reuter gave you that statistic, there was a distinct feeling that we were going to make lower lows than even the 1708, which I think was the number. So there was concern about inventory once again. And whoever, Andrea, is responsible for that rally, God bless them, because it probably saved any number of firms. We were one of them, without a doubt. So thank you for the answer to the perfect storm.
Eric, you've been left off the hook thus far, both because of your different status at that time, but I do want to come to you now to say, do you hear any echoes? I mean, we understand and wouldn't ask you to discuss the details of the Commission's involvement in the events of this summer and going forward, but as you listen to this, are there echoes in current events as we try and turn to some of the lessons going forward?
I think it's fair to say that there are there are some echoes. Some of the things that were still that were important at that time in 1987, I think, remain important today. On the other hand, some things have differed. So, for example, technology is probably the single thing that's changed the most. The change is both positive and negative. I think, you know, the idea of carrying a BlackBerry, having that kind of communication is obviously very positive. We also carry little wallet cards that have the name of all the critical staffers around Washington and in the Fed in case you need to get in touch with them. So inside my wallet at all times, I've got that card. I don't know if people carry. Rick, did you guys carry cards like that at the time? Okay. All right. So, you know, I think we've come to expect and prepare for these things. So there was some learning that went on. I think other things that I think there are some eternal lessons that come out. Pricing would be one that I pick. If you ask the question, why do you keep a market open, and, you know, we may talk more about decisions to shut markets, but one of the most important reasons to keep a market open is that it produces a price. And with a price, you know the value of your holdings. You may want to buy, you may want to sell, you may not be able to do either, but knowing the price has a remarkably salutary effect. If you think about what's been going on recently, speaking in just terms of generalities, one of the things that's been very difficult about some of the credit events, and we have had a credit set of issues facing us, is people didn't know the price of that which they held. And I think there's a terrific parallel there, because think back between 87 and think back to where we are today. In both circumstances, people had doubts about the price. Some of it was because on the New York Stock Exchange, prices were asynchronous. You didn't know if those were valid or not. Today, it's a different reason. The securities, the credit contracts are, in fact, just very difficult to value because they're idiosyncratic. But for that same reason, people don't know inherent values. Today, these securities that we're interested in, that we're talking about, the credit instruments, don't trade on an exchange. They're over-the-counter instruments. And so the exercise of what it takes to get a price is, in fact, much more difficult. You need a model. You need a procedure to get a price. And, in fact, stepping back from that, I think that's one of the generalizations for what's different today. The OTC market, especially through the use of contingent claims and derivatives, is much more developed today than where it is. I would never want to go so far as to say we couldn't see a substantial break in the equity markets. Who knows what we might see? But I think what I would say is proportionately, we're more focused on non-equity markets today. And I think we put a lot of energy into facilitating the integrity of our non-equity markets, the OTC markets of various kinds, derivatives, fixed income, all these sorts of things. We pay a great deal of attention to you know, some things you can't do anything about, pricing, because it's an over-the-counter market, but we can't do things about infrastructure. So, for example, the New York Fed's been putting together a group, spends considerable amount of time working on settlement issues for over-the-counter instruments, settlement being the core issue having to do with money in securities trading hands. Getting that right becomes critically important.
Chairman Cox, you had a very different catbird seat this summer than as a senior staff member at the White House. Any observations you can share with us about sort of those differing perspectives and experience?
Well, first, on the face of it, what happened in July was very different and not nearly as serious or significant as what happened back in 1987. I mean, you know, the Dow is not adjusted for inflation. It's just a naked number. And so a 100-point drop or a 200-point drop or a 300-point drop is very different depending on what time period you're talking about. But, you know, whereas we had, you know, in one day an over 22% drop back on October 19th, 1987, none of the days when we were all listening to CNBC in panic this last summer was there a drop of more than 3%. And so we're just dealing with apples and oranges in terms of the magnitude of market events that we're talking about. Second, I think we really have learned lessons from 87. We've learned lessons, in fact, I would hope, from every market disruption and worse that's happened in our history, in our modern history. But in particular, what we've learned from 1987 is, as Eric says, markets are the answer, not the problem. So when it comes to questions of keeping markets open or closing them, what you want to look at is not whether or not the market should be open as a question of you know, contributing to panic or not, but rather is there something mechanistically going wrong? Is there some reason that price discovery isn't working? Because as long as it is, that's the way out. And I think that's probably the most important lesson that we can keep in mind in the very different circumstances that we'll probably find ourselves in the next crisis. Just lastly, with respect to planning, something else has happened that was not technically a market event, but it so affected the markets that it's the latest learning since 20 years ago, and that's 9/11. Because 9/11 was an attack on the financial sector. It was an attack on Wall Street. And so in consequence of that, this agency, having lived through it, and financial firms having lived through it, have done a whole lot of contingency planning that otherwise they probably wouldn't have been motivated to do. Anytime you do this kind of fire drill, it's got to have a cost justification, and it's a distraction from making money. So getting people's attention and getting their focus is very difficult. But 9/11 was a great aid in that, and a whole lot of planning is now routinized. We have a Department of Homeland Security that takes into account one part of our critical financial or our critical infrastructure, the financial sector, and we with DHS and other parts of the government now routinely participate in planning sessions. Those planning sessions aren't limited to the United States. We do them with our overseas counterparts. We recently did one with the FSA. I am absolutely certain that if you go back beyond 20 years in American history, there's just no precedent for that. So we are far better prepared in that way than we ever have been before.
Let me add one thing that I think has also changed. You know, we've talked about automation and technology. One of the ways we at the Commission have dealt with this in the staff of market regulation is we actually have an automation group now. We have a group of folks within market reg that deal explicitly with issues of automation at the SROs. So we have a lab, if you will, of computers, switches, routers that run the same technology as the exchanges. We look for issues about robustness. We look at issues about durability, hackability, those sorts of questions. And we, of course, have hired a specialized group of people to deal with exactly that. Very different approach to the question of what's important. I think it's a recognition of where the pressure points and the stress points are.
Without trying to press you too much on details, has the evolution of your consolidated supervised oversight mechanism changed your ability to make the phone calls that Rick and David were making on the 19th to gather information?
I think it's had a pronounced effect. For those of you who don't know, up until recently, large broker-dealers that were large and in parts of large holding companies did not have a consolidated supervisor. That changed in 2004. The SEC is now the consolidated supervisor of very large investment banks like Goldman, Bear Stearns, Merrill Lynch, Lehman Brothers, Morgan Stanley. As such, we can see into firms in ways that we couldn't see before. Prior to 2004, we could look into the broker-dealers, but we couldn't look into the non-regulated entities. And as a matter of practice, instruments such as derivatives of various types are not held or struck in the broker-dealer. They're struck outside of that for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is capital and margin and those sorts of situations. The result, of course, was that we as a supervisor could not see those contracts. We could not see how they were being managed. Once the consolidated supervision program came into effect, we could look at the totality of a large firm. So you take one of those five firms, it may be that a U.S. broker-dealer has a very, very long position in a particular contract. Let's say there are very, very long U.S. equities in the U.S. broker-dealer. It may also be that in the London broker-dealer, they're quite short U.S. equities. So in totality, they're flat. Up until our ability to look on a consolidated basis, we didn't know that. So what I'm telling you is that's helped a great deal in dealing with risk management issues. The point of our program, of our consolidated supervision, is to look at financial and risk controls at the holding company level to preserve the health of the regulated entity. But also, we have within that a kind of systemic risk mission that is to minimize the demise of one of these firms, the probability of the demise of one of these firms, which, let's face it, these firms are big enough where they'd be seriously impaired. It could have an effect on the financial system. So it's had a remarkably large effect.
Chairman Reuter, as you've been pulling your thoughts together, what do you see on a continuing basis?
Well, what's happening in our markets, of course, has been the development of the electronic communication networks, the ability of markets to trade in 1 second or less, to have the trades go in and out, to have the trades be done by algorithms and programs in which there's no human intervention, to have very large amounts of securities in these algorithms, or the ability to have those traded through these algorithms. You have large stock trades, shredded into small amounts. You have programs in which stocks are in which there are buy orders that are canceled in very short times. And then you have in the market also a very opaque group of players. These are the people that are, we might call hedge funds or others who are engaged in derivative instruments of various kinds, not likely stock instruments, but other kinds of derivative instruments, in which there's no regulator that knows what's going on. Jerry Corrigan has been in charge of a group that's been looking at counterparty risk, but they have not been able to reach the non-regulated players. So we have a group of people people that are in this market who are in a total market of derivatives and other instruments, not necessarily equities, who have positions that we don't know about and that we don't know what the risks are. So we have an unregulated group of risk takers, difficulty with counterparty analysis, automated trading, large program positions, and then the possibility that that the pressure from such as the credit markets to may be that you'll end up not being able to pay off your credit position, so you have to sell your good assets, which may be stocks, and may go over to the stock market. At one point after I was chairman, a few years after that, I made a point of going to the New York Stock Exchange and talking to Dick Grasso and saying, well, I'm no longer chairman, but I'm very concerned about how your system is coping with demand. And I learned then that it isn't volume that's important, but the number of messages. Really my question is whether there's sufficient unknowns out there so that we might, both with regard to the nature of the risks, the volume of what might happen, and the question of system capacity in this new electronic era that may cause at least clogging in our securities markets, which needs to be addressed. And Eric, I'm delighted to learn that you're doing that, as I assume you are.
We are. I think as part of our automation review, capacity is always one of the questions we ask about. Rick, you would probably be able to gauge this. I think capacity is up roughly a factor of 1,000 compared to what it was in 87 in terms of messages at the New York Stock Exchange. I don't know where you are today, but I think the data I have here, do you have 1,000 times the capacity, quite literally?
Yeah. I think that's a very good estimate. Yeah, I mean, there's been enormous achievements in technology capacity, nor should we kid ourselves that we don't have more work to be done. Creating capacity with far simpler systems than existed before is far cheaper, far greater ability to deliver it and deliver it quickly to respond to changing events. And the marketplaces are more diverse in providing access to liquidity. So there's a lot of reasons to feel very, very good from a technology capacity standpoint. On the other hand, the participants in the markets today generate almost unfathomable amounts of message traffic, and the increase, the slope of that message traffic in a volatile time is also pretty daunting, if not unfathomable. I think there are loads of reasons from a technology standpoint, certainly for the New York Stock Exchange and all the markets that I've seen, to feel very good, and I think that was demonstrated by the way the equity markets held up to very difficult times this summer. But we shouldn't kid ourselves. The technology capacity is a continuing battle for marketplaces that will justify market reg's attention for years to come.
Well, can I ask you to talk about some of those issues, Rick, a little further? The one that I just want to throw out for the panel is one of the theories of 87 in part was that people didn't fully anticipate the degree of sustained selling that would be triggered by various portfolio insurance strategies, because those were essentially upstairs strategies that weren't priced into the market because people didn't know the size or nature of those. The echo I thought I read in some of the papers over the summer was various kinds of quantitative trading strategies that turned out to seemingly act in parallel to one another, generating sustained selling effort on a directional bias. And again, people didn't seem to know how much inchoate selling pressure might come into the market with certain triggers.
Is that still with us? How do we get our arms around it? How do regulators think about that? Do regulators think about it, or is it something that is just when it happens, you'll get priced in when it happens? Or am I chasing ghosts?
Well, no, I don't think you're chasing ghosts. I think, as always in this story, there's lots to feel good about and lots to still suggest we have work to do. We talked about it from a technology. You know, if you want to sort of tick through the issues, and Andrea did a good job of this before, that really created uncertainty in the markets in 87, technology capacity and lack of access stands at first, firm capital issues, lack of diversification for firm capital, and oversight surprises from a governmental standpoint because of limitations were real. And clearing, the lack of effective offsets, not at nearly as realistic risk management from DTC as should exist in an environment way improved from a cross-margining standpoint and risk. But you go down the list in each three of those things, and there are still challenges. We talked about it with respect to technology capacity, as good as anyone should feel about that. With respect to the firm risk and the questions of what happens with exuberance and the likelihood that people will depend on automated programs, given new classy words each generation, now we have algorithmic routing, that effectively make decisions on a probabilistic basis that requires separate thinking outside of the statistics to deal with the tails, to deal with the unusual, exceptional, extraordinary event and what will happen, and the basic fact that liquidity disappears disproportionately as volatility increases, and that it becomes very difficult to statistically describe how to react and to maintain a risk balance profile in those exceptional circumstances. And that's a long way of saying is we've solved a lot from the standpoint of firm controls, the fact that firms have vastly more effective risk management. I lived with that vastly more effective risk management at Citigroup for a year. It was really good. It still continued to struggle, as all firms demonstrated they struggled this time, with respect to dealing with the tails, with respect to moving past where the statistics didn't work anymore and you had to do scenario evaluation to conclude what was likely to happen in areas that it had never occurred before. And that, I think, is the balance between art and science that is not helped by the fact that with respect to well-paid people in the security or financial industry generally, the upsides of being successful substantially exceed the downsides of blowing out and getting fired because you missed one. And there are no simple reactions to any of those things except hoping there were clones of Jerry Corrigan at Goldman Sachs everywhere in the securities industry. But it does reflect the challenges we have as to how you take risk management and deal with it as it moves from science to art with respect to the very unique situations in which as a result of lack of transparency, access, et cetera, markets don't move the way you predict they do.
You know, I want
to terrible thing for a lawyer to say when I've got an economist sitting over there, but it still, I think, is a challenge.
But you said tails twice, so you count.
You know, you said something in the beginning that I want to pick up on. Rick, you had said this, and I think, Andrea, you were nodding your head. You said one of the things you're trying to understand in 87 is where the exposures were. And if you think back to what, you know, think back a few months where we are now, I think that was a question we asked ourselves very much, is it happened to be over-the-counter instruments, but we wanted to know where the exposures were. Technology hasn't helped at all with that. In fact, technology has made it worse because the footings of these firms, their positions, you may know them with perfection, not that you ever know, but you may know them with perfection at some point in time. With technology the way that it is, they're trading more. They're moving their positions much more fluidly. You can swap out of a big oil exposure and be into a big old gold exposure within half an hour or faster. So, of course, our ability to know the footings of these firms has changed. And so that question, as basic as it is, we probably have less knowledge of today than you did at the time.
I'd like to comment that technology does a lot of things, but often for exchanges, technology is reactive. The original DOT, which standard for designated order turnaround, was for the purpose of getting the 100-share order to buy or sell stocks on the New York Stock Exchange or trade it in NASDAQ to get it there quickly, to get it priced and to get it turned around and sent back to the ultimate customer. It was not designed in those days for some strategies that took advantage of it and obviously glommed up the system to some degree. But I think changing gears a little here from the exchange's viewpoint, and this was happening within the industry as well. I mentioned that we had about 50 firms on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange in 1987. Today there are 7 firms. They are parts of significantly larger member firms. You know the names, Goldman Sachs, Bank of America. There is a Dutch firm, Vandermolen, that owns a specialist on the floor. Bear Stearns owns a specialist on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. And there is a firm that is a public entity and has gotten permanent capital by going into the market and selling its stock to individual shareholders. That change is the most significant change from the standpoint of exchanges that came out of the 87 crash. The fact that they had this permanence of capital, the fact that they had the ability to go get lines of credits from banks, that they weren't reliant upon grumpy old men my age's capital supporting the firm, and my concern about, gee, would I ever be able to get my capital out of my firm if something untoward should happen, if October 19th had turned into the 20th and the 21st with similar days of decline, 22.6%, which is highly unlikely but possible.
Could I just raise one other question? One other change that exists now is the growth of overseas stock markets. In 1987, it was basically Tokyo and London that we looked at as markets with volume. But today, we have markets in China and South America and much greater markets in Europe than we ever had. And one of the questions that I think needs some thinking about is what possibilities are there that market calamities will be transferred from a foreign market to our market? I don't have any answers to that. I just raise it.
Andrea, did you want to talk a little bit about the present?
Well, I'd just say I think 4 things. One is that you have to, I mean, we know in futures markets that you have to expect a flight, I would call it, to transparency when there's a problem. So you have exposure from business that's being done upstairs or in the less transparent market moving to the more transparent market. I think you have a flight to quality that pushes sometimes redemptions. It pushes sales of certain products. And you have increasingly, and people worry about this, you know, you have this, I would call it disintermediation of the execution function because of the need to have this speed of transacting. And so the electronic connection to the market is typically given to a customer, at least on the futures side, if it's a big customer, and the broker is now performing largely a credit enhancement function, something that was actually the subject of a Supreme Court case just the beginning of this week. And I think that people aren't really sure what to do because they have good risk management at the broker itself, but now what they're worried about is how good is the risk management of their customer and how do they demand that their client have controls because as Chairman Cox mentioned, you know, people are, when they're making money, they're really not thinking about controls as hard as probably they ought to, and it's very hard for the compliance guy or the math guy or the economist or the quant who does controls to go, who makes, you know, a few $100,000 a year to go into a $9 million a year income trader and tell him he has to stop doing what he's doing. And finally, I just say I agree totally with Rick that the issue is what do you do about the unusual outlier event? I mean, I think everyone is relatively confident that the markets have the capacity to address the day-to-day, that the modeling that we have is really good. But I go back to the event of the market crash, and I read an article about the hurricane that occurred. And you know, the meteorologists were all fired because they had failed to predict whether the storm on October 15th had closed London's markets on the 16th and felled six of the seven Kew Garden Oaks, had failed to predict whether it would be a 30-year type storm or a 300-year type storm. And it seems to me that that's where you're at, that if you look at the litany of events that have gone, as somebody says, it's the black swans that you're worrying about, and by the way, they don't happen every 100 years. And so, therefore, what we really are doing when we do risk management in financial markets is we are trying to contain the damage from the outliers without impinging unnecessarily on the ability to take the kinds of risks that make a vibrant, innovative, effective, efficient market. And so financial risk management is really the art of managing the unpredictable, not the predictable. And so I'm sure that there's more to learn in this area, and hopefully we have shown a lot of flexibility in our system, and I think it's a flexibility that's broadly envied around the world.
Eric, I don't want to put you on the spot, but it's just too nice a segue not to invite you and Chairman Cox to talk a little bit about the difficulties. Chairman Cox mentioned scenario planning post 9/11. The question of how do you plan for the unpredictable always strikes me as at one level oxymoronic and at another level a very sensible and understandable question that it's the things we don't know that are the most difficult to try and anticipate. We get to kibitz, you get to live with it and deal with the consequences.
Well, we can live with oxymoronic. A prefix makes all the difference. It really is a worthwhile effort to try and anticipate what normally you just wouldn't think of. One of the things that we lean on very heavily today is in fact an outgrowth of 1987 market events, and that's the President's Working Group on Financial Markets. It's an institutional way of coordinating policy making and exchange of information among the leading parts of the federal government with responsibility in this area, starting with the Department of the Treasury. The Secretary of the Treasury chairs it. The Fed chairman is a member of it. The CFTC chairman is a member of it. And I'm a member of it as chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission. The President's working group has been very active over this year in response to what's been going on in the market. We've addressed ourselves systematically to issues such as credit rating agencies, mortgages, counterparty credit risk, hedge funds, and private pools of capital. We have a communication system that is formalized that starts with the staff and that escalates depending on what's going on, but we also have routine formal meetings of the principals and a lot more informal. So I think it's a great way to address what we have to always focus on, and that's what's coming next, not what happened last time. And one of the things that the PWG has done is exercises. When John Snow was secretary, I participated when I first became chairman in the first of those. We've, as I said, recently done one with the FSA. That was a PWG exercise as well. And planning these scenarios is itself instructional. I know from my days as chairman of the Homeland Security Committee where a lot of this event planning and scenario enacting and so on is very important and very routine, that the quality of the exercise really makes all the difference in the world for the participants. And so by contributing our expertise into writing the scenarios, we also awaken ourselves to possibilities that we might not have imagined. There's just a lot more focus on this than there ever used to be. We'll never be good enough to know whether it's going to be for sure a 30-year or a 100-year or a 300-year storm, but the more attention, the more resources, and the more coordination, the more likely that you're going to do your level best to be prepared.
Let me follow up at a slightly more granular level here, and this is this question of risk management and how we deal with issues of risk management. Largely for us, we focus on the systemically important firms, which would, again, be these so-called CSE firms. Most of our effort is, in fact, spent with risk management questions. And they become first order because our concern is the preservation of the regulated entity and minimizing a problem of systemic proportions. This program is very different for us because it is, in fact, prudential in nature, so that it's changed very much it's very different from a traditional SEC program in the sense that the staff, for instance, that deals with it is in market reg. It is a staff of economists, statisticians, auditors. We go in and work with the staffs of these large banks, looking at their models, auditing their models, looking at the outputs of their models, challenging their assumptions. And there's a lot of give and take. There's a lot of pushback. Pretty clearly, with what's happened over the last, half year, there's been a lot more opportunity for questioning the assumptions of these models and the way they're implemented. But, the pressures that you cited are exactly what they are. The people sitting on the business desk want to take all the risk because the maximum downside they have is getting fired. The maximum upside they have is a 9-digit paycheck, and it's pretty clear to predict what they're going to do. Now, the firm understands that as well, so, of course, any sensible firm has risk controls put in place. But that said, there is an externality that's produced by these firms that we internalize as the regulator that they as the firm do not internalize someone who just runs the firm. By having a program the way we do, we are able to link risk management practices firm to firm to firm. That doesn't mean we go up to firm one and say, hey, let me tell you what the guys at firm two are doing. No, we just understand what they're doing. We're able, through our own expertise, to get some idea of where good practices are. And if we see a firm that's lagging in a particular place, then we have a basis for encouraging to bring up their standards. Sometimes they may not bring up their standards, but we have an adequate toolkit available to provide some pretty solid encouragement in that way. And I think, frankly, it's been a terrific give and take. Problems have escalated, and at times I've called CEOs of those firms and said, look, we're not happy with what you're doing. You need to make a change here. And that was about their risk controls.
Well, as we begin to get close to the end, I thought we might just take 1 minute to see whether anyone wants to volunteer what they might have done differently in hindsight. I know that what I would have done differently would have made more phone calls that weekend. And I probably would have gotten up earlier on Monday and spent more time talking to people in London to get a sense of what was happening in the London market, because it became such a marked predictor of what was going to hit the New York Open. And I think in hindsight, I would have anticipated that more directly. Andrea?
Well, I have a very esoteric thing. I mean, I would have realized, I think, I mean, if I... As the director of the Division of Trading and Markets, I should have realized that when the futures exchanges collected intraday variation settlement, that they didn't pay. They collected losses, but they didn't pay the winning side of the market. They held it overnight, and that exacerbated the potential gridlock in the system. And I think that, I think that this was a practice. It wasn't a rule, and it was something that we should have known was happening, but no one really felt that it was of concern. And, in fact, they might have even supported it conservative measure and against having multiple transfers should the market change overnight. That's why they did it the way they did it. But I think that the way they did it at the time exacerbated the problem, and they don't do it that way anymore. They pay and collect. There's a small holdback.
Yeah, I think my answer would be very similar to Andrea's. I think we at the SEC spent a great deal of time trying to understand the interaction of markets and the additional volatility, and that was good. I don't think we spent enough time looking at risk issues, looking exactly. And I think if you sort of see the the legislative efforts of the Commission since then and the regulatory efforts, it has been to get a broader picture of risk and a broader understanding of the firms that the Commission oversights. I think in 87 we didn't understand those needs in nearly the way, same way. We were very much in an ad hoc reacting to situations and understanding it. And certainly I would have known more about the risks involved in the risk management processes from a standpoint of options clearing firms and a variety of other things. But the basic focus on risk management that Chairman Cox so eloquently described now just wasn't a part of really where the Commission was at those times. I think we did a good job beginning to starting understanding and defining that risk, but not nearly amount. The other thing, and probably the thing I regret the most, was that shortly after that, in our demonstrating that we did have international connections in the time, in talking to a person out of the then oversight from the MOF at the Japanese Securities Administrator before they had an SEC-like vehicle, I can remember him asking me that they wanted to improve their communication any time there was volatility, and would it be all right if they would call me at any time that their markets moved a set percent? And I said, well, of course so. That then moved into a year-long fallout of the Japanese markets in which these guys called me at 5 o'clock in the morning, literally day after day for 120 days until I said, please, it's okay, I understand your market's going down. So that would be the other thing I would probably do differently.
My problem was that I didn't understand how much power I had when I came in as chairman. I'd only been chairman for 2.5 months, and Rick and his staff had described to me the possible problems in our markets, the possible cascade of a downside, and that the markets were in some sort of scary way interconnected. And I didn't really realize that I had the power to try to do something in advance. And what I would have done, had I really been with it, would have been to increase the coordination between the exchanges and the regulatory agencies in very dramatic ways. During the crash, I don't think that there were people at the New York Stock Exchange that had the telephone numbers of the people at the Merck. And I had gotten to know Cale Heinemann a little bit, and I was very glad I had, because I could call him and talk a little bit about it. But I didn't have a telephone number at the Fed to call. I didn't have I really think that what's gone on since then, the very great enhancement of interregulatory cooperation and exchange information cooperation has been a tremendous thing.
In 2020 hindsight, there is no doubt that we would have had more capital in our firm. We would have had the ability to reach out to the banks. We would have not had that silence on Monday afternoon, the 19th, from a bank that no longer is in existence serving trust saying, what's your name again, and you really think you need to borrow this amount of money? That's hindsight.
I think I'll let Chairman Cox and Eric off on this one. I think all that's left for me, however, is to thank Andrea, Chairman Cox, Billy, Rick, Chairman Reuter, and Eric. I would like to also remind you that the program is now preserved in the SEC Historical Society's virtual museum and invite you all to visit it. For those of you listening to the live broadcast, thank you for being with us today. For those of you in the SEC auditorium, I invite you to join Chairman Cox and Herb Janik, President of the Society Board, upstairs in the Visitors Center for the presentation of the Society's historic photo display. And I would like to make a special thank you to Billy, who sacrificed time from his family in Florida to make himself available today. And it was very kind of him to be here. And thank you all for your attendance, and look forward to seeing those of you here upstairs. Thank you.
Brandon, you have done a very complete job of wrapping up, with one exception. There is nobody left to thank you. And so sitting here on the end, I want to do that and tell you what a fabulous job you've done as moderator today. And once again, thank Andrea, Rick, and David, Billy, and Eric for being such wonderful panelists as your hosts. The Securities and Exchange Commission is just very pleased that you could be here with us today, and particularly thanks to the Historical Society for arranging for all this and putting this on. I will say that really we didn't need to turn any further than the formal program that they printed up to learn the answer to your final question, because the title of this whole session is Keeping the Markets Open, and that's certainly something that had we known everything we know now, we would have done better with at the time. The other thing is that on the front of this, there is a picture of the front page of the New York Daily News, and it's got an enormous headline, one word with an exclamation mark, and it says panic. And I suppose in hindsight, we would know not to do that.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.